Namo Buddhaya. Dear brothers and sisters, here we go. We've invited members of the Adhisthana community to come in the mornings to our sessions. In fact, they can come to anything they like. And the young women from the course are also coming. They're going to hear things they shouldn't hear, but we have deep trust in them. So Padmavajra and I are going to do a double act this morning, and I have the dubious privilege of starting the show, so Padmavajra can correct all my mistakes later and put you on the right track. So I was remembering that the order started in 1968, which, of course, for many of us is a very notable period of our lives. I don't need to remind you what 1968 meant. At that time, so many creative things were happening in the world generally, in the West at least, or at least in Western Europe and America, North America. But it's very significant at the same time as the order was starting, quite a number of very, very good films were being made, especially on the continent. And I'm particularly going to draw attention to a film made by Pier Paolo Pasolini, an Italian filmmaker, called Teorema, Theorem. And it's an important film because it does sort of introduce a new kind of, well, you could say spirituality, which is rejecting of conventional Christianity. Pasolini was a Marxist, so it's socially subversive. But at the same time, it's got this very, very lofty, aesthetic, spiritual dimension to it. Bhante refers to it in the Vimalakirti Nidesha series, the Inconceivable Emancipation. So in the film, Terence Stamp, a well-known British actor who still treads the boards or is on the silver screen occasionally, rather faded, at that time a very beautiful young man. He comes to a bourgeois Italian family who are some sort of industrialists. And there's father, mother, daughter, son, and a maid. And it's never explained where he comes from or why he comes. He's just there as a guest in this very bourgeois family. There's very little dialogue. I think there are 90 words in the whole film. Very well chosen words, of course. Slowly what happens is that the visitor, Terence Stamp's character, seduces every member of the household. Starts with the son, then goes on to the maid, then the mother, and then, you know, blow me down, the father, and then the daughter. And but the odd thing is, I say he seduces them, and actually he doesn't seduce them at all. He doesn't try to, you know, get inside them, as it were. He doesn't try to seduce them. They are seduced by him. His presence, his beauty, his self-containedness. He's reading at one point Nietzsche. I can't remember which book by Nietzsche he's reading, but he's reading a Nietzsche book. It might be The Will to Power. But he's just irresistibly attractive to them. And one by one, they, well, it's not even that they seduce him exactly. They're just drawn into a situation where seduction takes place. They always take the initiative. And what happens is he goes, and one by one their lives are turned inside out. on the whole, not in a particularly apparently positive way. But they're certainly not the same after their encounter with the visitor. And Pasolini saw this as a sort of an expression of the way in which a spiritual power, he talked about the Christ power, but clearly he meant something, not Christian, subverts the oppressive social order, the bourgeois capitalist system with its oppression, according to orthodox Marxism, of the working classes. And the intervention of this higher force just turns everything inside out. It really pursues in much more stark, well, not stark, much more simple and clear outlines the theme that he'd started with the Gospel according to St. Matthew, which is Christ as you've never known him. Christ as a social revolutionary, essentially. So in this film, Pasolini shows in a quite brilliant way, I think it's a very great work of art, he shows that the subversive power of the, let's call it spiritual, advisedly, with many inverted commas and so forth, of that which comes from a higher dimension, that which comes from a transpersonal dimension, supra-personal dimension, its enormous power to disrupt and to transform, often not in comfortable and pleasant and easy ways. But once it interacts with the world, it leaves the world completely transformed. This is Pasolini's theme, but worked out in entirely visual form. There's no theory in the film itself. The film just expresses all this through the symbolic action, and quite beautifully shot, brilliantly shot. I strongly recommend it. Terence Stamp, interestingly, after that film, became interested in things spiritually. He was for some time a follower of Gurdjieff, and even went to Pune, and went to the Rajneesh Ashram, and he spoke of the role that he played in the film as like the role that Rajneesh played for him and for many others. So Bhante used this film as a kind of metaphor for Vimalakirti's role, Vimalakirti's disruptive role, as expressed in The Inconceivable Emancipation. Vimalakirti just turns the lives of the bodhisattvas and the arahants upside down by his own utterly uncompromising wisdom. And yes, Bhante called upon the image of Terence Stamp, the visitor, as an emblem for Vimalakirti. But I want to call on that film, and maybe even Vimalakirti, as an emblem for Bhante. And actually I want to call upon Bhante as an emblem for that transformative, erotic power in its quest for beauty and its effect upon the world. We're going to talk this morning about Bhante as daimon, or you could say as Bhante the servant of Eros in pursuit of beauty. We're going to talk about him because Bhante is our teacher, and the order we belong to is the order of his disciples and his disciples of his disciples. So clearly, if we want to practice in accordance with his particular presentation of the Dhamma, we need to have a vivid impression of him in the round, from all points of view. We need to be able to take on board Bhante as the servant of Eros in pursuit of beauty, as much as Bhante the wise expounder of the Dhamma, Bhante the translator of the Buddhist tradition into modern terms, Bhante the founder of an order, and so forth. There's also Bhante the servant of Eros in pursuit of beauty. And in many ways, that's more who Bhante is than than any of the other versions of Bante. All the other versions of Bante are expressions of that, workings out of that. So we're looking at Bante the daimon, Bante the servant of Eros in pursuit of beauty, in that connection, as his disciples and disciples of his disciples, and ones who are practicing in accordance with his particular presentation of the Dhamma. But we're also talking about him because his life, if we can manage to communicate something of that flavour that we have got from him, it enables us to understand better what Eros in pursuit of beauty really means. Because when you see it embodied, when you see it worked out in an individual, it's easier to relate to. Inevitably, I shall give you theory. Padmavajra will give you a lot of poetry. Philosopher and the poet on the stage, although we'll exchange roles indiscriminately and you won't be able to tell the difference. Yes, we'll try to communicate through the image of Bante, through what our experience of Bante was, something of what it is that we're talking about as Eros in pursuit of beauty, which I think you could say in some ways is the most fundamental aspect of Bante's teaching of the Dhamma. Of course, as with inevitably with somebody of such a rich imagination and such a multitude of genius, a genii, his ability to communicate in so many different media, means that you can't exhaust Bante by saying he's this or that or the other. But in many ways, this servant of Eros in pursuit of beauty perhaps captures Bante, the man, more than any of the other versions that we might hear of. So that's why we're approaching things in this way today. Over the next days, we'll start to explore more the theory and the imagination connected with Eros in pursuit of beauty. But we want today to anchor that in the man. So much that one could say, and so many different stories one could tell. But my own experience of Bante very early on was that he was completely unconventional. But actually, even to say he's unconventional implies that there's a sort of opposition between convention and unconvention. It's more like Bante didn't even notice convention. It didn't sort of exist for him. Boundaries and barriers just weren't there. He wasn't subversive in the sense of, being a rebel and deliberately trying to undermine or something like that. The conventions just didn't really exist for him, didn't bother him. He wasn't bound by them. At the same time, he wasn't, well, perhaps this is draws out part more of what I'm trying to say. He wasn't, he wasn't sort of obviously unconventional. Yes, when I first knew him, he had very long hair and these enormous mutton chop sideburns, which were pretty strange in a man of his age and his generation. I remember my very first experience of him before I knew anything about the order and the movement. I lived in the same area as him, and I just saw him walking towards me with a long brown cloak, which was strange enough for an older man at that time, not for my generation, but for his. Then the long hair and these great big mutton chop sideburns. And that just sort of drew me to the figure. Again, I knew nothing about him. I didn't realize he was a Buddhist monk or anything like that. I think I was pretty stoned at the time, so I wasn't completely sure whether it was really happening or not. as he came towards me, I realized that there was something very, very different about this person. In India, there's a lovely expression, alag, alag, different, different. And different, different connotes something more than just different. It's different, a difference of a sort of almost transcendental kind. This man was really different. I suppose he was what we would now call extremely mindful. Every step he took, he was fully taking, walking like an elephant, as they say in the sutras. And extremely focused, very strong sense of containment, but at the same time of enormous energy. Something very, very contained, but at the same time just full of energy. Extremely attractive. All this just a flash, but it's left an indelible impression on my mind. This man who was, well, I thought of him at the time as the first mature person I'd ever met. You know, when you're growing up, you suddenly realise that all the grown-ups aren't actually grown up, and that they're all basically big children masquerading as adults. And it passed through my mind, this man is really mature. And yet, most people, when they mature, they harden and stiffen and narrow. But this man was completely open. All this in a flash. That's what he was like. I remember one of those immortal occasions that life brings to one. I remember driving Allen Ginsberg to see Bhante and then driving him back. He came to London and regarded Bhante as a friend and wanted to go to see him. So I went and collected him. The journey over was notable only for us quizzing us on our sex lives. But on the journey back, he said, that guy, how is it that somebody so revolutionary can write such square poetry? And then in a way that sort of captures Bhante. He's so much part of the great tradition, so much a man of enormous erudition and a very, very highly cultured and very sort of well mannered and very he's not messy or unconventional in that way at all. From an ordinary point of view, he's a decent citizen, as it were. And yet, there's something really revolutionary about him. I think Allen Ginsberg probably was a little too wedded to his own version of poetry, but that's another question. Bhante had that sort of quality of enormous freedom, uncontainment, still does. At the same time, he's not deliberately subversive, he's not rebellious, he's not deliberately sort of going against the stream or anything like that. In the ordinary sense, he's going against the stream in the sense that we must all go against the stream of the conditioned, if you like. But he's not going against convention merely for the sake of going against convention. My generation put on a great show of unconventionality, which meant we all wore the same sort of unconventional clothes. And all wore the same unconventional long hair. Would that we could still, but... Bhante just didn't do that. I remember trying to sort of find out from him why he grew his hair long. And because I assumed it was some sort of statement. I couldn't get a satisfactory answer from him. And at the time, I assumed it was his way of trying to identify with us. I think that's far too sort of rationalised a version of what Bhante did. He doesn't seem to sort of do things in order to... he doesn't put on a show in order to communicate something. It just happens like that. He also had loads of rings on his fingers. I remember that sort of horrifying me the first time I saw him. I walked, rather shy. Oh, no, very shy. A 22-year-old. I walked down into the centre in central London, Monmouth Street. I had to go through a shop which was distinguished for not selling anything. It was a Zen shop. And at the back, there were some stairs that wound down, very narrow stairs. And I remember there were two Buddha's footprints on the ceiling, which freaked me out. Downstairs, there were just two tiny little rooms. And I went down, extremely shy. I found going into sort of group situations very difficult at that time. Bante was sitting in the corner, as it were, dressed in his robe, surrounded by people who were in the most acute English social embarrassed silence. Americans and Mexicans and others won't understand, or Australians won't understand, but this experience that English people have when they don't know each other. They just go completely stiff and pretend that there's nobody else there. So people sitting around like that, I made immediately for the notice board to read notices, because that was a way of pretending I wasn't there. And Bante just sitting there completely at his ease as people came in, just, you know, giving them an eye up. And, you know, frankly, giving them a complete eye up. Wearing this filthy robe, it seems so to me, long hair, mutton chop, sideburns, rings on his fingers, the wildest figure you could imagine, extremely attractive to a young would-be hippie, but at the same time, really rather frightening. There's something extremely dangerous about Bante. Not that he was ever personally dangerous or anything like that, but you felt that here was somebody who you did not know what he was going to do. You didn't know how he was going to respond. And you felt that he saw so much more than you did. And I remember that evening, or maybe it was a slightly later one, it was a question and answer session. And I was absolutely entranced. Everything about him, the way he spoke, so carefully phrased, his grammar, absolutely perfect, but completely flowing, articulate, beautiful use of words, sentences wonderfully balanced, and with a really deep and acute understanding of whatever the topic was, but answering the questions in such simple, clear terms, and with such a delightful sense of humour, a sense of humour that would always done with his teeth open, his mouth open, and these not very good teeth. He's had them done up since then, but in fact he's had them removed since then, but he had, living in India, he hadn't had very good dental treatment, and his teeth were a mess, but he'd grin, his teeth all over the place, and a really wicked sort of smile. And I found him really attractive. I don't mean physically, not particularly attracted to men in that way. I do mean physically, but not sexually. But there seemed to be a sort of glow to him, a kind of golden glow to him. As he's sitting across the room, he's only 10, 12 feet away from me. I was sitting leaning against the wall on one side, he was sitting on the other side. And I just completely entranced by his mind, the way in which he thought, the way in which he articulated himself, and the beauty of his expression, and the charm of his expression, and the charm of his wit, so gentle but wicked, if you know what I mean, with a real kick in it, but never hostile or unpleasant. And sort of slightly mocking, but never dismissively mocking. And often slightly mocking the questions, but never in a way that you'd feel offended or anything like that. A beautiful, beautiful event. And I just entranced, and I just gazing at him. And it was the first time I'd ever seen anything like that. Completely unthinking. I wasn't cogitating at all. I was just entranced. And he looked at me. And, you know what happens if somebody looks at you who you don't know. You both of you break off eye contact as quickly as you can and as politely as you can, because, you know, that gets a bit risky. But Bhante just kept looking back at me, long past the point when he should have gone on to the next question or something like that. He just kept looking back at me. And, you know, I was sort of caught in the act, and I kind of didn't want to look away. So we just looked at each other. And this wicked, wicked grin came on his face as he looked back at me. Probably lasted 5 seconds, but for me it lasted several years. And I felt he was sort of like saying to me, okay, here I am. There you are. Now what? And that sort of incident, I could tell you so many incidents of that kind with Bhante, where Bhante offered himself to me in an absolutely direct way. I never had sex with Bhante. I wasn't involved with him in that way. He never made an approach to me. I don't know why. I used to be quite worried about that at one point. But he sort of in a number of situations he just gave himself to me and entered into my world, often more energetically than verbally or in any other way. I have had wonderful Dharma conversations with Bhante. I'm just thinking about it last night. I remember sitting in a car. I'd driven him somewhere, and I was sitting in the front of the car outside the place where he was going to go, and we talked for, I think, 45 minutes, an hour, about the wheel of life. We're talking about rebirth and the Nidana chain, and he's clearly absolutely loving it. My curiosity, my questioning, my trying to catch him out, as it were. He's absolutely loving it, and basically he seduced me in my medium, if you see what I mean. He offered himself to me in my medium. And that's what I think he did to people. He wouldn't play any game of matching your expectations or dealing with your desire to please or be accepted. He wouldn't do that. And sometimes that could be very uncomfortable if you wanted Bhante's approval. You really didn't get it. I don't think he thought it through. He just couldn't respond in that situation. And I must say, there have been times in my life when that's been extremely painful. But I know what he was doing, because I've experienced the same thing the other way around. You know, when it just becomes impossible to communicate because the person on the other side wants something that you don't have available. Because it's not to do with you, it's to do with them. And, you know, we deal with it in different ways, but with Bhante, you just couldn't get in. You know, at the time I felt angry with him, upset with him, but I now understand what was going on. It was to do with me. I created something that couldn't connect. He couldn't connect with. He's, on the whole, been nothing but encouragement to me. Encouragement sometimes in my most crazy aspirations and intentions. I've hardly ever had a no from Bhante if I wanted to do something. And in fact, often he's the one who's dropped something in and then sort of, you know, having lit the flame, then just fans it until it's ablaze. All the time the sense that he's coming from this vast awareness and this huge energy, which is highly emotional. You know, Bhante, especially now maybe, and in the past as well, can appear a very cool character. very cool indeed. But I think if you get to know him at all, you realise that this is a man of blazing feeling, really intense feeling, but it doesn't show itself so easily. And I've seen some extraordinary moments when suddenly you get a glimpse inside this sort of cauldron of feeling. And I don't mean negative feeling at all. Sometimes it's a sort of anger, but not anger in the sense of destructive, or rather hateful anger, but more a kind of fierceness which will not suffer falsity or a distortion or unfair behaviour or that sort of thing. Just you suddenly see that Bhante cares deeply about us all, cares deeply about our movement, really, really deeply, and that when he sees it subverted, for instance, bullying at one stage, that's when I saw it most clearly, is utterly, utterly horrified and hurt, pained by it. You see that this is a man of the most deep and intense passion, that he is driven by an erotic charge, charge of eros in this deepest sense of a force that goes beyond the person, and that is driven towards, well, beauty. All love, Plato says, he puts into the mouth of Diotima in the Symposium, and then into the mouth of Socrates, but Diotima says that all love is love of beauty. And Bhante, you can see his love is directed towards beauty. What exactly that means, we're going to find out slowly as the days go by. Hopefully this afternoon we'll look a little bit more closely at what Bhante means by beauty and in what way all love is love of beauty. But you can see that in him, that he can see his deep, deep attraction to beauty. Beauty, even physically, in the individual. Beauty in art and in nature. Beauty in poetry, especially. Beauty in meditation. Beauty in the Dhamma. Beauty in reality itself. You can see that Bhante's life is more than anything a pursuit of beauty. And I hope that we'll really get to understand what that means, because I have felt that because for many of us that's not sufficiently vivid, we turn to more conceptualized expressions of the Dhamma, more conceptualized pursuits of the Dhamma, which are not wrong, and they may even lead in the right direction, but that we have in Bhante and what Bhante's given to us such a living flame that if we would only plunge ourselves into that living flame, well, it would burn us up as separate, constructed self-identity, and allow us to really burn in the Dhamma, burn in reality. So I hope that I've at least given you some idea of what we're trying to do, why Bhante is so important as an emblem of this, and why this particular approach that we're trying to take is so significant. Padmavajra and I are really rather humble about what we're trying to do. We're not, we're looking at what Bhante's had to say. It's so vast in this area and so subtle that we're not completely convinced that we can pull it off. But if we can only pull off your interest in looking deeper into Bhante and what Bhante had to say, we feel we've been successful. But I'll now hand over to Padmavajra, who will take up the theme in his own inimitable way.